Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podlog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Hey, Terry, good talking to you again.
Hey, Yoni. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. So we just listened, it was over a week ago now, but we just listened to that audio from Len's interview that we had recorded. And we talked about how we needed to get together and really flesh it out and discuss it some more on its own episode. And I wanted to start with a thought towards you, is when I was listening to it, the part that was a little challenging for me was when Len's talking about the continued salvation concept, and that was a little hard. I think that's gonna be hard for Jewish audiences, with the idea that he didn't finish the sentence, but for me personally, I felt like maybe he's alluding to the complete picture of Judaism includes Christianity. And I know that's hard for a lot of Jews. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, best memory serves, I took him to be, I think it would have made more sense to me if he had said continuing sanctification as opposed to salvation. Because this is where you need to kind of keep me honest. I don't know whether or not that notion of sanctification is as troublesome for the Orthodox Jew as the notion of salvation is for the Orthodox Jew. I know that for me as a Christian, there's a very big difference between the process of sanctification in this life, where I'm growing closer in my relationship with the Savior, I'm growing closer with my walk as a Christian, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not that I'm perfected through sanctification, but I am being perfected. I am growing in my faith and in my exercise of that faith. But it's not necessarily salvation. Salvation is not a matter of that sanctification. Sanctification is a consequence or a follow-on from salvation for a Christian. It's how we live as Christians if we're living right as followers of Jesus. Now, I suspect that there's a similar but significantly different sense of sanctification for Jews. Is that right?
Yeah, that'd be correct. And maybe to clarify the two terms, there is within Judaism, and I'm talking from the Orthodox Jewish perspective. So within Orthodox Judaism, salvation's really not that, it's not there. They're not concerned with salvation. It's very much a here and now faith practice. What are we doing now? Are we living Torah now? Are we following mitzvot? And sanctification is definitely tied into that. I mean, we view sanctification in the lens of doing, not only doing these things, but also sanctification meaning to be sanctified, which means to be set apart, is that we're to be set apart from the rest of the world. So I don't know if you've ever had the chance to see Jewish communities, but people in Jewish communities will typically dress different than the rest of the community. There'll be, sometimes it's the standard white and black that you'll see, or there'll be a shtreimel or a fedora or something, but there's a lot of different types of things that Orthodox Jews will do in their daily life that practically provide that set apartness, but it's also a physical reminder. So for me personally, I wear zitzes. And so I've got these fringes coming out of the corners of my shirts. In that way, Judaism is a bit of a fringe religion. But for me, yeah. So for me, when I look at these fringes, what it is it's supposed to be a sign. And when we say the Shema, we say that it needs to be a reminder. And we talk about the zitzes during our recitation of the Shema and how we're to wear them on our four-corner garments. And we don't have four-corner garments today, so we make them so that we can wear them, so that we have mm-hmm. them on us for us to look at them. Because the idea is when we look at zitzes, it keeps us from following after our own eyes and our own heart, which can lead us astray. And it keeps us going God's way, which is proper and true. So I think sanctification, probably the closest bridge we can connect on that one, is that type of approach where we say, yeah, we believe in sanctification. We believe that we're supposed to live a certain way to be observant of Torah, so to say. And that's what we do. When we have a lot of different ways that we do it, there's great diversity and variety. But the idea of sanctification for us is we're being set apart because to follow God's way of life compared to this contemporary culture is very much set apart.
Yes, I think that would resonate very solidly with me as a Christian, and should with most Christians, that set apartness, be in the world but not of it. So I think that's a good tread in the bridge, if you will.
Okay.
I would say, just kind of as a footnote to all that, as you were speaking about the set apartness and the reminders you have of being set apart, the fringe and so on, the fedora, the black and white, I haven't spent much time at all in Orthodox Jewish communities. I did, when I was in New York with IBM one summer, I was close to a Jewish neighborhood. So I would go through that neighborhood sometimes just on a stroll. And I was very aware that I was in a completely different cultural setting because, and I could identify things like the, what do they call the curls of hair that men have,
yeah,
and the beards and the rabbi hat. I don't know, you know, I don't know the terminology here, but I would just, I would bottom that out by saying the semiotics of that set apartness for Jews, the Orthodox Jewish community, is much richer than anything Christians do. You know, we put fish bumper stickers on our cars and we wear cross and fish bling, you know, but that's not at all the same thing. It hasn't anything like the rigor, I think, and I mean that in a good sense, that the semiotics of that set apartness has for an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Yeah, no, we have a lot of our life. It's very much a, it's regimented, not in the oppressive, oh, I have to do this, 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 and this, and this. I mean, some people can definitely see it that way, and I think it's easier for outsiders to see it that way. But we just set ourselves apart. And we say, you know what? What I'm here for, I'm not here for my own pleasure. I'm not here just to get a high out of life. I'm here to accomplish a greater good. God put me here on this world for the intentional, specific purpose of there's certain things that I specifically am supposed to do to help fix the world.
Yep. That's true for Christians too. I hate to go so far as to say this, but it's only fair of me to be upfront about it. I'm rather a dissident Christian. And by that, I mean mainstream institutionalized Christianity lets me down far more often than it edifies or nurtures or feeds my faith or strengthens my Christian walk. It's just, I think it's failing in the way that what you're describing is more successful in the Jewish community. And by that, I simply mean, I don't encounter people in the mainstream institutionalized Christian world who take that mission of being a light to the world, go and make disciples, you know, the classic ministry mission in the world, not of the world, and making disciples, that purpose in the world. I just don't find that many people in the Christian community who take it seriously and make it a lifestyle. They pay it a lot of lip service every Sunday for 45 minutes and see them an hour later, you know, and it's, oh yeah, what was he talking about in the sermon today? You know, it's a big disappointment to me.
Well, you know, I guess there's some comparison features there too. I mean, within the Jewish realm, you definitely have that variety. You have a lot of individuals who aren't necessarily as connected and as part of it and integrated. And so that's where we come from the term frum, F-R-U-M. It's Yiddish for observant within Orthodoxy, for example. So like there's some Orthodox Jews at the shul I attend, shuls of synagogue. So there's Orthodox Jews at the shul I attend where they're not necessarily observant on the same level that others are. We all have our different variety. There's this range in which we operate. Right. And
it goes back to that distinction you drew in a recent conversation between the Orthodox, the conservative, and the Reformed.
Yeah, but this is just even within the Orthodox in particular.
So oh, I see.
Not even taking conservative and reform into consideration, we have different levels of observance within Orthodoxy. And that ties to, well, was the person just born into Judaism and they didn't have a choice? Or did they choose to convert? Or did they walk away from the faith and then come back to it? Or were they from birth? And so for those who, a lot of Orthodox Jews by and large are born into it, they didn't have a choice, and there's leniency given there and saying, you know, you didn't have a choice. Whereas for a convert, so in my case, you're right, because my father's Jewish, not my mother, I have to go through the conversion process, Bali Ger, right? That process, there's a lot more things I have to do, observances I have to do, than other people in my synagogue will ever have to do. Technically,
right.
Are we held to the same standard by God? Yes. But God's
yeah.
not right here, right now, telling them what to do. It's a self-driven lifestyle. And so for
yeah.
me, you'll see me a lot more observant in other areas that maybe other Orthodox Jews in the community aren't, simply because of the standards, and that this is something I'm choosing versus something that maybe they didn't have a choice. Because within Orthodoxy, there are some that, you know, you're born as an Orthodox Jew. And so you're born Jew, you have these obligations as a Jew, you can't choose to not have these obligations. So they may not necessarily put all their heart into doing it, but they check the boxes.
Right. So it's like a free will choice versus a rote discipline or duty.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Okay. So what else came to your mind about Lynn's position? I knew that that salvation, continuing salvation, was a kind of a sticking point. But what else kind of got stuck in your craw in that interview?
Well, not necessarily stuck, but like, how do we digest this? How do we work with it? Can we work with it, right? So there's also the concept, we talked about evangelism with him. And he presented evangelism as that's just who you are doing what you're doing, which is a different position than what people typically view the word or how that term means. But in what he was talking about, he was saying, you know, you're telling me that Torah is true, and I'm telling you that Jesus is true. And that back and forth dialogue he had with his friend that was a Jew, which is great. And I think those dialogue sessions are a great opportunity for people to build bridges and connect. From a lot of the Orthodox Jews I have interacted with, their answer hasn't been, well, Torah is true. They said, well, Torah is true for me, but for you, who knows? And it's more of a, I guess one way is I've talked with one individual in particular and about this conversation, and his response was, see, that's the typical Christian response. A Christian learns one thing, like, oh, I need to go share this with everybody I know. And then the Jew learns one thing that says, oh my goodness, there's so much I don't know. I better study this for a decade before I say anything.
Yeah, I chuckle because I kind of, I mean, I've been a Christian now for probably a quarter century. I didn't come to Christ till late in life. And I've been there for about 25 years. And at my very first, you know, awakening, if you will, or that first moment of redemption, I expected to have, because I'd been around Christians all my life and I'd basically just become an agnostic as a result. But once I was grabbed, I thought, oh, I don't feel like running out and telling the whole world about this. What's wrong with me? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that was almost an imposed expectation that I would be so overwhelmed with the joy of it all, I wouldn't be able to help myself but to run and tell the whole world and start screaming in people's faces to convert them, that kind of rabid evangelism. And 25 years downstream from that feeling of guilt and uneasiness, I look back on it and go, boy, I sure did get influenced in the wrong direction by the Christian community. Because now, as I try to fit, my first hurdle as a Christian was to fit half my life at that time, about 40 years. I had to try to fit about half of my life of upbringing in an agnostic environment at home and becoming a philosophical agnostic by the time I was a sophomore in college. And the pathway from my grade school to that sophomore year in college was all about philosophical thinking, hard as that might be to believe at 5, 6, 7 years old. But that's how Benjamin Spock children were raised. That's what it was to be raised as a Spock child, was to think for yourself. So I had a very Socratic kind of dialogue with my parents. All of that to say, by the time I was a sophomore in college, I was very much influenced by like Whitehead and Russell and the analytic tradition and philosophy. So I was a dyed-in-the-wool agnostic. So the first decade, and even still to a certain extent, my struggle as a Christian is how I take everything I learned about analytic philosophy of science and formal logic and mathematics and all of that, and put it together with this other absolutely more overwhelming and absolute truth of of faith in Christ. How do I put those two things together? They're both knowledge. I can't just say, oh, well, science is false now, because it isn't. And I can't just say, well, Jesus must be the scientist of all scientists. How does that work? You know? So struggling with how to put those two together is a bridge I've been trying to build between the two halves of my brain since I became a Christian. All of that to say, the position I'm coming to kind of bring my comments full circle here, the position I'm coming to as a dissident Christian these days is evangelism is probably one of the most bastardized words in the English language. Religiously, corporately, I mean, corporate world stole it from religion first. I mean, I can remember being at IBM and being trained in how to be an evangelist for mainframe technology. You know, I mean, it was a little absurd. So it's a real difficult word to try to use. That's why Portland Seminary changed their name, remember?
That's true, yeah.
So for me, that classic in-your-face street corner preacher throwing pamphlets in your face is just, it's a cartoon we need to get over. For me, evangelism, there are three aspects of it. And this is classic. There's the witness, the testimony, and the one nobody wants to talk about anymore, that's the apology or the apologetics. Because apologetics is hard. Yeah. Witness and testimony are personal stories. They're easy to tell. You can tell them with full of emotion and zeal and passion. But apologetics is where you have to put all that aside and say, okay, now, more or less objectively speaking, as analytically as I can make it understood, how do I justify what I believe and why I believe it? You see? And people don't want to go there. There are Christian theologians popping up all over the Christian literature that are saying, oh, apologetics are no longer needed. It's a waste of time. We saw that happen in our own cohort, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I'm this dissident Christian, and this is a real struggle I'm having. I'm not going to be that street corner evangelist. I'm drifting further and further toward the pearls before swine, dogs returning to their vomit perspective, which says, you know, I'm not just going to throw this at you. You want it? Come ask me. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I do have something valuable. I do hold on to a treasure here. But I'm not just going to throw out on social media to start a rant fest or to troll for rants. I'm going to kind of hold back on this. And if a conversation kind of gets drifting in that direction and you bring it up, now we can talk. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of flies in the face of the traditional Christian concept of evangelism, you know, but so be it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, where I work, there. Let's see. In the direct area I work, I've got a Christian, an ex-Catholic, current agnostic, and then me, the Orthodox Jew, and I also have an anarchist. So you know, we get a wide variety of opinions. But the typical Christian response is to bring their faith up or a component of that into most of the conversations. I hear the same type of evangelism, I guess, from the agnostic ex-Catholic regarding to being anti-religion, and then the same thing from, you know, the anarchist regarding there's problems with the institution and how this works, it's just not feasible. And
right.
So what I'm thinking about this is maybe in our conversation with Len, maybe evangelism was the wrong word. Maybe we need a better word. Maybe evangelism is so muddied and so overwhelmed, it's too much effort to try to change the world for the populace, change that word for the populace, just leave that as it is, and we use a different word. We use like engagement or something that allows us to interact with each other and to bring ourselves to the table, but not try to force our opinions on each other.
Right. I think what I took him to be saying, because when I hear the word evangelism even coming from someone like Wynn, I've gotten to where I tune it out because it's such a hot button word that it's lost its any clear, crisp, reliable meaning. It's so ambiguous and so emotionally overworked and overloaded that it's just not worth the trouble. So when I heard him use that, you should be evangelizing me, I should be evangelizing you. When you evangelize, you should come away more evangelized than the person you were evangelizing. That's how I remember those remarks going.
Yeah.
When I think of that and take the evangelism concept out of it, the first word that comes to my mind is challenging. I don't want to just say engage. I mean, that you can engage and just be carrying out social etiquette dialogue. You know, it's a very shallow, let's go back to your partis distinctions. It's a very shallow level of interaction. But when my interaction with you in our sessions challenges me to think more about my faith and challenges you to think more about your faith, now we're getting past that first P level of the conversation, right? And we're starting to drill deeper in both of our worldviews. I'm drilling deeper into yours and learning about it causes me to drill deeper into mine and rethink and rehash and, you know, reaffirm and strengthen my convictions and maybe throw some out that suddenly show up to be, you know, I was wrong about that. So to me, it's a challenging engagement. And mutually so. We're challenging ourselves to be challenged, and we're challenging the other to allow themselves to be challenged. And that's not what evangelism ordinarily means. It means quite the opposite. The other person's got a closed mind. I have to break my way into it and force them to think like this. That's the misguided conception of evangelism in Christianity, I think.
See, that's something I think can be worked with. You know, when we're talking Jewish-Christian relations, that's a big part of my dissertation. And the idea that, well, we can challenge each other and we can, it, let's put it this way. If I go into a conversation with you and I come back and it helps me understand my own faith concept more and it helps me have a desire to know more and explore Judaism more, that's a good result. And that's a very good thing. And we should be thinking critically and analyzing and following up. The part that becomes a little muddy, a little hesitant when we're talking like Jewish law halakha is when somebody goes into a conversation and they walk out disillusioned and disbelieving about their own faith structure. That's dangerous. That's a problem. And so, for example, with Jewish Christian relations, it's hard for Jews to have that type of relationship if they're not able to do that. But if instead we can engage and we can support and challenge each other to grow and learn more about our own faith constructs. And Judaism and Christianity are so incredibly similar and actually help each other out in so many ways. I see that as a totally feasible and realistic option.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, so then challenge is definitely a better term in that regard.
I think so.
So then the only other thing that I was thinking about is that I thought Len brought up a really good point. Is it when he said a lot of Christians don't know their origin story? And that's actually something I had mentioned in my dissertation when I was writing it, is a part of that challenge is having an origin story. I mean, we know this with comic book characters, right? A comic book character has their origin story. But what if their origin story, they don't really know their origin? That's a problem. And I can't think off the top of my head of any specific comics that may be connected to that. But I know that we all have what we have as our origin story, but do we even know the origin to our origin story? And so,
Good point.
like when I think about Christianity, I look at Judaism, I see, you know, there's a lot here that Christianity and a lot of Christians don't know about that came from Judaism. And historically, that was intentional. I mean, we see that both on the Jewish and Christian ends. The Jewish end was trying to separate the two faiths. I mean, the Christian end tried to do the same thing. They tried to reduce the reliance on rabbinical figures with the Council of Nicaea when they separated the calendars and they separated the holidays. And so I think that historically, that loss of origin story is because of the concern of trying to separate these two groups so much that they don't really know what the other group is anymore.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I talk to Christians frequently who have basically said, "Oh, all that Old Testament stuff, that's already been done away with, right? I mean, Jesus fulfilled all that. We didn't have to think about it anymore." No. You don't, but you have no idea what you're giving up and losing if you don't. I mean, I think that's true. And frankly, Yoni, that's exactly why I'm doing these sessions with you, because I feel like as a Christian, I have a responsibility to understand the vine I've been grafted into.
Yeah, no, I
And that
totally get
vine
that.
is the view of history.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, you know, Jesus was Jewish. And I know that
No.
some politicians have said that Jesus overcame his Judaism, but I'm pretty sure that's not how it works. But, you know, Jesus was Jewish. And I mean, Joseph Talushkin, we've talked about him before, but he's a very respected rabbi within Orthodoxy, Conservative, Reform. Pretty much all the main Jewish groups recognize that this guy knows his stuff. And he writes right. about Jesus in his book on Jewish literacy. And he says, you know what? Jesus was a Pharisee. He was a Jew. Yeah. He knew his stuff. And if you look at the words of what he was teaching, he didn't teach to abandon the law. He said, no, keep it. So it's not Jesus that a lot of Jews have a problem with. They just don't know that. And that's because they don't know. But if they did know more about Christianity, they'd say, oh, it's not Jesus I have a problem with. It's like a local rabbi. He's made Aliyah, but he loves to quote Jesus to other Jews. He doesn't say, oh, this is Jesus. But he just makes a comment. And it was great. One time he had somebody come over and they were cooking in his house and they burnt their food and they let out a string of cuss words. And he looks at him and he says, you know, it's not what goes into your body that makes you clean. It's what comes out of your mouth. And the guy's like, that's pretty profound. He's like, and the rabbi replied, yeah, I was a great Jewish teacher that said that.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a very cool story.
So yeah. I see that as understanding happens, our conversation, we have a lot of understanding with each other. We've done this cohort for 2 years now, and I used to be a Christian, and so we have a lot of connections to connect us. But I think for a lot of other individuals, this is where this podcast gives that opportunity, is they may be Jewish and know nothing about the Christian narrative, or they may be Christian and know nothing about the Jewish narrative. And this provides that opportunity to say, hey, we can get along. We do have similarities. Let's talk about this. But you and I are doing this in this deeper level, I'd say, than what most daily interactions would be, because we aim for a semiotic theological analysis in many ways.
Yes, we do. May it please God that we can pull that off and still have people listening to it.
Sometimes it may be hard, but yeah, we do our best. So in regards to what Len said, I've taken up a lot of the, here's what I thought, here's what I thought, here's what I thought. Was there anything that really stood out to you that you wanted to address?
Well, interestingly enough, this didn't come out of that interview, but I know this really kind of struck us both as missing a mark. It was in his Facebook post, I think, where he said something about every Christian is Jewish. Those weren't his exact words, but every Christian is a Jew was the thrust of it.
Yeah.
And that really kind of pushed a button with you, and it struck me as really odd. I mean, I was gobsmacked when I read that post. And so you and I touched base pretty quickly. And what I came to as a way to kind of sit comfortably with what he said was that grafting into the vine metaphor. We are adopted children of that father. We are not children in the way that the ethnic Jew is. You're the firstborn, as it were, of that tribe. I'm being a little kludgy with how I'm saying this, but maybe that's a point we should take up further down the road. But that's something that Lynn has said recently that just really, you know, kind of caused me to go, wait a second. Well, I got to process that for a while.
Yeah, I just pulled the post up again because you know we're talking about it. It was June 27th. He says, Jesus was a Jew. All Christians are Jews. Jews who believe a Jew named Jesus was the Messiah, not just for Jews, but for the whole world. That's like a semiotic bomb. There's so much there to discuss and analyze that I don't even know its own episode would be enough. But, I mean, if I were to break it down, we talked about how Jesus is a Jew. All Christians are Jews. I could see that in a metaphoric sense. Ethnically, that doesn't work out, as you've already talked about. But even observance-wise, there's a lot I do that I'm pretty sure you don't do and you don't want to do.
Well, it's interesting. My son-in-law, married to my younger daughter, John is his name, he graduated from Southeastern Seminary in Lakeland, in Florida here. And he's a very committed Christian, I think, in to use the Orthodox term, I'd say he's pretty close to it. He has very clear principles that he lives by, and they're all very faith-oriented towards Christ. Now, interestingly enough, the last time I had a Seder was at his house. Yeah. He had the Seder meal at his house the last time. That's Easter, right?
Yeah, it's around, it's Passover.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the same time, sometimes they're a month apart, but you can take Nicaea.
They were very close together, which is why I associated with Easter, but I knew it wasn't really Easter. Yeah, it's the Passover feast or meal. And he often appeals to some of the Old Testament law as the way Christians ought to be living. So I think he took Jesus as you did, that it isn't that we're pardoned from or excused from or, you know, kind of waved out of being obedient to the law. It's that we should fulfill the law. We just don't have to worry about the penalty of sin as much.
See, that's interesting. That's interesting. That's something we're going to have to dive in more to, I think. But because, yep. You know, from a Jewish perspective, we don't look at it as a penalty of sin thing. We look at it as a, well, I do repentance each day for my sins to God, my sins to man. I can only resolve with those people. And that the law or following these mitzvot isn't about cleansing myself or making myself worthy of salvation or forgiveness of sins. I mean, I can just pray, God, please forgive me my sins. And that's sufficient within Judaism. We have our ways that we do it, but that's really the essence of it. We do the mitzvot, these extra things, out of our love relationship, I guess. Just like how you and your wife Peggy have a Torah on your marriage, you know what really pushes her buttons and you try to avoid that. And you know what she really likes and you try to do those things. We do the same thing with God.
Yeah. I didn't mean to imply, I may have misspoken. I didn't mean to imply that obedience to the law or a lifestyle in resonance or harmony with the law is a form of penance to resolve one's sense of guilt.
I don't think you did. I just think that's one of those things. It's a bridge we'll get to, but the conversation of we have a different purpose for the Messiah. And I know that we have an episode regarding end times and eschatology and all that coming up. And we'll get into that then. But our view of the Messiah is different than the Christian view. And so we don't look at the Messiah in the salvation lens because we're really not focused about salvation. We're like, yeah, I have a relationship with God. Yeah. If I do these things, if I'm good, not good is a very ambiguous term here, but just for the sake of being ambiguous, if I'm good, there's a good place to go to. And if I'm bad, there's a bad place to go to. We recognize that basic component. And again, that's something I think we can better cover in one of our next episodes. But we don't view our Messiah in a salvation lens. We view it as in a, we get our kingdom back and we get to live in the land and all Jews will be Torah observant and there will be world peace. And that's really what our focus is. Judaism is very much that's a here and now religion. And so you'll find within Jewish circles, a lot of people can't comment much on what they're looking for in a Messiah or the world to come because Judaism really doesn't focus on it.
I see. Well, we better focus on the time.
That is true. I mean, we're definitely going a little longer, so which is fine. Sometimes it's good. Anyways, so I guess we've got another call coming up soon. We'll record our session, and we're going to be talking about eschatology, right? Did you want to give like a teaser, like 20 seconds?
Sure. Most people, Christian, Jews, Catholics, Muslims even, and almost every world religion has some sort of eschatology, some conception of what's going to happen at the end of time or at the end of life. What happens after death, what happens at the end of the age or period we're in, and so on. And that's what eschatology technically means, some conception or theory or theology of what happens in the end, both personally and universally. And that's what we're going to talk about. What does the Jewish eschatology say about that, and what does the Christian eschatology say about it? And more to the point, are they different? And if they are, which I expect they are, what are those differences? And there we go again, looking for another bridge.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to our next episode.
Me too, Yoni. Thanks.
Thank you.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semiobites is a podcast co-hosted by Yedberg and Semio City to answer Semitic questions via Semiach analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semiobites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin. Musical consideration provided by bensounds.com.